With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome to Your Own Personal Beatles. We're back with another fabulous episode this week. I am Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
How's things? Have you had a good week?
Yeah, it's
not
bad.
Seems like ages since we last spoke, because we pre-recorded last week's episode.
Yeah, we're sort of falling gently into autumn. How's autumn for you?
Autumn is, as I look out the window, beautiful, but it's not really matched by the sort of incredibly frantic week I've had moving house.
Oh yeah.
I'm feeling very out of touch with just general life, because I've been basically pulling stuff out of boxes and putting things into boxes as the variety of life.
That sounds nice. Your new house looks very nice. I can see it in the background there. You've got your records on the shelf there.
Well, I mean, one thing about moving house is you do begin to see the benefits of the humble MP3.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that loss of high-end quality is a price worth paying.
Yeah.
Good. But speaking of which, actually, I rediscovered an album because it's something that I did dig out right at the beginning of these podcasts, but something that I was needed to reassess. And, a little reminder of that was an email this week that came from Chris Demetriou, who said, "Hi, Jack and Robin, I hope you're well. I just wanted to say thank you for your excellent podcasts on the Beatles. I describe to most other Beatles podcasts out there, but really like your unique take on what they mean to us personally.
Oh, that's nice.
I also like the fact that you don't go in for the hagiolatry of some other fan podcasts, which I must admit is a word I just looked up, and it means the worship of, for example, saints."
Yeah, I thought you said Hegelian. I thought you said Hegelian. We could be the only Beatles Hegelian podcast. I don't actually know what Hegelian is either. But
no, me neither. But let's whack it in the description.
Sure, sure.
See if we get any extra downloads. So he goes on to say, "I hope I'm not disrespecting your guests when I say that while I've listened to and appreciated every episode you've put out so far, thanks very much, Chris. The one I enjoyed the most was just you two nattering away to each other."
Oh, that's nice.
Which is very nice. In that episode, though, there is something I have to pull you up on.
Oh, no.
Here we go. You were discussing Lennon's solo years, and I think it was Jack who said that while Mind Games was a good song, everything else on that album was pretty dross. I'm not sure if you were referring back to Double Fantasy or about the Mind Games album, but, and this is going to be my controversial Beatles-related opinion, I think Mind Games is Lennon's best album.
Nice.
Give it another try. The title track, Bring It On Lucy, Out of the Blue, one of Lennon's best songs. You Are Here, so much good stuff. Anyways, I hope you don't mind me getting in touch, and keep up the good work.
Nice.
Absolutely not. We love people in getting in touch.
I'll have another deep dive into that one.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I didn't go back and listen to the first episode again, but it does sound like some sort of flippant remark I might make. And I do remember the week after we recorded that, listening to Mind Games and thinking, oh, I was a bit harsh on that. I'm not with you on You Are Here, but I think,
which is the one with Dream Number 9 on, because that's a good album too.
That's on Walls and Bridges.
Yeah, I like that one. But I think the whole problem with this this Hegelian podcast, the nature of the Hegelian podcasts in and of themselves, is there's so much spirit discalia, isn't there? Like constantly regretting saying something.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wishing exactly. You got it right. Or
well, and especially it makes you... I mean, we're doing a 20-episode run, and I think we're episode 15 in or something, and it makes me realise how much I have learned from doing it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I've done so much reading and listening since we started that I kind of naively thought I could get away with just sort of thinking of facts that appear in my head, rather than actually looking stuff up.
Yeah, and I've changed my opinion on quite a few things.
Yeah, me too.
And Mind Games is probably was just me having not listened to it a while and putting too much credence into the sort of lukewarm reception that it got. But I do like loads of tracks on it. I think the criticism that is leveled at it is that it's a little bit toothless, and it's sort of Lennon sort of beginning to betray the fact that he's running out of things to say, and that the anger has kind of dried up, right. Which is fine. And there are a bit, there's one too many saxophone solos on it, but
you don't get a sax solo anymore, do you? I was listening to Sade a lot, and you really get a raspy sax solo going on. You don't really hear it so often these days.
No, my friend Dom refuses to listen to anything with a saxophone in it. And
I'm like that with fretless bass, to be fair. I'm not, but like fretless bass was a cancer. Yeah, it's like everyone in the 80s was like, what the fuck is that? I want it. It's crazy.
Yeah, bizarre. So, you know, we're very willing to change our opinions, but, you know, I'm still hold firm on Obladi Oblada, which comes up in this podcast and is also the subject of this email from someone called Desmond.
Nice, appropriately.
He says, welcome. I've spent too much time glued to the pod, which I might add is fantastic. My personal Beatles sits firmly with Sgt. Pepper and dancing around the conservatory at 7 years old with a full Beatles history lesson from my Uncle Philip. Nice. We were transfixed. Don't tell my dad I still have his vinyl. Fast forward 25 years and I'm listening to the pod on the reg. I figure I'm a pro, but hold up. I'll just paraphrase what's happened here, but Desmond is he's in San Francisco, USA. Nice. He's had a few cans. There's been a buzz at the door, and he's gone to get his McDonald's. It's midnight.
Is this a stream of consciousness like now? What's happening?
I'm just sort of paraphrasing it because he's a few sheets to the wind, and some of the he tends to mix his tenses. But I've had a few cans, and I forgot my keys. I'm left outside with nothing but a Big Mac, my phone, and a pair of earphones. Having just listened to the last pod with Kevin and Jem, he is basically going to try out some, in quotation marks, new music. I plug in and search for Rubber Soul for the very first time.
Wow.
So here I am on the stoop, locked out, listening to the first time on what I'm dreaming is going to be the best album ever, never heard by my ears. Have to say, disappointed, distinctly average.
Well, I think he might be getting his experiences confused with the listening process there. I mean, if you're locked out of your house, Rubber Soul isn't really going to slap, is it?
No, I mean, he says perhaps it's the cold, but turns out you can't beat your personal Beatles, and yours will always be the version of what you remember in the moment.
Indeed.
In its best light. As my controversial Beatles opinion, my favourite song is Obladi Oblada, and it will likely be the song for the first dance at my wedding.
Aww.
Much love, Desmond and Molly. And if you're called Desmond and you're getting married to someone called Molly, I think whether you like Obladi Oblada or not, you've got to have that as your first dance.
Definitely. That's lovely. What a great email.
But I would say stick with it, Desmond. Rubber Soul, it definitely is good.
Yeah. Yeah, love San Francisco. A great pub called the Hemlock Tavern. You know, it's probably closed.
Well, there you go.
So you may remember I've talked a few times about being in the band Gravenhurst, which was led by Nick Talbot. And I'm very close with Nick's brothers, Paul and Sean, as well. I used to live with Paul. And Paul sent me a really nice email, which is, Paul had a very strange attitude to washing up, though, when I lived with him. He sort of put everything in the dishwasher when he could have just washed up a teaspoon, sort of held everything to ransom. It was a bit frustrating. Anyway, his mum, Mercia, he told his mum, Mercia, who's a huge Beatles fan, about the podcast, and she wanted to tell her personal Beatles story. She definitely wanted to really clarify that she was not an Apple Scruff. She definitely wanted that kind of emphasized. But she said she had a great story about, I was working in Oxford Street, had a half day, and on the off chance went to St. John's Wood with a friend from work who was also a fan. This was in the 60s, by the way, not just the other day. Had been there early in the year, but was told by his housekeeper that he was in Scotland. And when my friend and I got to his house, there were about eight other girls hanging around. So those were the Apple Scruffs, of which she was not one. Fans like myself were known to the Scruffs as tourists. However, on this day, which is about 3 days before Christmas 1968, we waited a few hours and we knew Paul was at home because he had a few visitors who had to speak to an intercom to be let in, and we heard Paul reply to them. Can you imagine the excitement? Mm. As I had come on the off chance, not brought my autograph book, I had to scrounge a bit of paper and a pen from someone. The gates opened and Paul appeared in his Aston Martin car. He stopped the car. It's quite Partridge. Paul is quite Partridge.
Yeah.
He stopped the car and I went forward with my pen and paper in a state of delirium. He said, hello, red lips, and I like your floppy hat. It's so nice. That's not great. Sure in what order, as it was a long time ago. He signed my bit of paper and added a kiss. That's so nice. But the great thing as well is Paul Paul's dad, Peter, also has a really great Beatles story, which I really like this one. So my dad, Peter, worked at what was then Midland Bank at Heathrow in the late 60s doing currency exchange. John came to the desk on the way back from India. So this is, you know, when they were writing all the White Album stuff. So about 1968, looking very hippie, according to my dad. He wanted to change rupees to sterling. My dad told him he couldn't exchange them as the rupees were effectively worthless. John said, "Thanks for the experience," and walked away. That did make me laugh, because you can really hear John's voice in that one.
Yeah, that's amazing. Great. I love that, like, even the most boring, like, Beatles story just somehow manages to be, like,
I love Hello, Red Lips. It's great. Oh, and Mercia Enter email. By the way, we must have a chat soon. I ran at the weekend and spoke to Sean when you were away. I really miss you both. So, Paul, give your mum a ring.
Great stuff.
Paul Talbot, not Paul McCartney, by the way. But yeah. Paul was named after Paul McCartney, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's left-handed.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, there you go. Good stuff. Thank you so much. And keep them coming in. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can email me at jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. Mm. And thank you so much for all the donations that people have given into the show. It has really helped us, and it's incredibly appreciated. And if you want to be one of those lovely people, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate. You can also get in touch with us on social media at Personal Beatles on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever, if you want to share your stories with there. But we won't keep you any longer, because we've got a fantastic episode coming up with the brilliant musician, arranger, producer, writer, co-founder of Space Bomb Records, Matthew E. White.
Well, this was a really great episode. We kind of got quite nerdy about production stuff. Like, Matthew is obviously a producer, so that was really interesting. There's a nice bit where we were talking about, you were talking about kind of how Sgt. Pepper was the first album which kind of had an impact as an album in America. And I'd always known that, you know, Rubber Soul was bastardized for the American market, as in tracks were taken off Rubber Soul. I'd completely forgotten that Revolver was as well. So, you know, the Revolver that was issued in America, it didn't have I'm Only Sleeping and Your Bird Can Sing and Dr. Robert. I mean, Revolver without I'm Only Sleeping is absolute insanity, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was it because of Yesterday and Today?
So there was an album called Yesterday and Today, which contained tracks from Help, Rubber Soul, and
Revolver. Which is
Revolver.
The infamous Butcher cover.
Yeah, the Butcher cover, which is rather shocking if you want to Google that. But yeah, that's a very strange album. It's got Drive My Car. It's got Yesterday on it, obviously. It's got And Your Bird Can Sing, which is, you know, it's a bizarre album, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really driving around the houses.
Yeah. So it must have been like, so that was what was interesting, chatting to Matthew E. White as an American about that kind of, those touchstones don't quite exist in the same way until you get to Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I really found it fascinating the way that he talks about how British and Americans have a different kind of relationship with the Beatles and stuff. And the British is probably slightly more kind of tabloidy and obsessive with the personalities and stuff. It was a really interesting take on it. And he has some great stories about his time growing up overseas, listening to the Beatles.
Yeah, and, growing up on Penny Lane in the Philippines.
Yeah, amazing. So it's fantastic. The biggest revelation for me was working out that his fantastic debut album Big Inner is in fact called Beginner.
Well, it's a play on words, isn't it? We totally missed it.
Much like the Beatles, which I didn't realize was a pun until I was about 20. So he's a really superb guest. We won't keep you any longer. Here is Matthew E. White's Personal Beatles.
We're delighted to welcome to your own Personal Beatles, Mr. Matthew E. White. Hello, Matthew.
Yeah, hello. Very glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Have you listened to the podcast?
I listened to the first couple episodes, yeah.
Cool.
And then I actually stopped because I was like, I'm just going to pick up on...
Yeah.
I want to be, fresh
sure.
content.
Yeah, I mean, I get bored of podcasts. I stop listening to it to myself, you know. Yeah. It's just two idiots talking about something they know nothing about.
No, it's fun. This is fun. It's great. It's a nice subject to dig into.
Yeah,
it's definitely intimidating talking to English people about the Beatles. I feel like there's something to that.
Really?
It's a different I think it's a different experience. That was when I started touring over there, was I like to ask people about the Beatles because I think it's so different. I can't quite put my finger on it, but
there's a sort of, maybe it's a sort of slightly, well, you know, when people say the British sense of humor sometimes doesn't translate. Is there an element of that, you know?
Well, maybe, but I think it's more like they're like an English band. They're you sort of feel like they're one of you.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me or to Americans, it's they're kind of other, you know. They sort of come out of over there and landed over here.
They are a bit sort of like the royal family in that they're really ubiquitous. And everyone's kind of pretty fond of them. But I suppose if you meet, like, American Beatles fans, they're usually, like, mega Beatles fans.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a different... It's just a different... But also, I feel like... I don't know. Sometimes I feel like English people, or some English people that I've met, have gripes with them, and like, more minor gripes.
Right.
that would never have occurred to me.
Like, almost as if they're friends.
Yeah, like, they're kind of part of the family, and they're just, like, annoyed at Paul for something. It's like, I don't... Wow, okay, cool.
It kind of reminds me in a weird way of when I was playing with Jan at Thiessen, and they obviously knew Andre Previn as a very famous musician.
Funny.
But like in Britain, you basically know him because of Morecambe and Wise, this comedy show he appeared on. And it's like, and showing that sketch to French people was like incredible. They like couldn't believe it, kind of thing. So it was,
that's interesting.
Kind of, I wonder if there's an element of that as well, where it's like maybe. We're familiar with the Beatles more kind of in terms of the popular culture as well, maybe, rather than the music.
Mm. Yeah, it could be. I noticed that on the first couple podcasts, actually, there was like a lot of people talked about that a little bit, about the sort of the cultural impact. And I guess for me, or like the celebrity of it and the their sort of personal, you know, who Paul is or who John is or who George is, like as people and as sort of characters in the theater of it all, like that's for me, that's so little of my experience with the music. It's kind of interesting.
I think it's like a lot of it's sort of tabloid culture as well,
because
they are a sort of like, they have, Paul especially has that kind of almost royal status, so we do tend to know everything about his the ups and downs of his divorces and all that stuff.
Yeah, right.
British people are just like preternaturally fascinated in that sort of behind the scenes stuff, I suppose. Yeah. But I guess like Elvis is probably the American like equivalent, maybe, of like that kind of superstardom.
Yeah, probably. But Elvis isn't nearly as interesting musically.
Yeah.
And he's and that doesn't really go on anymore.
Do you ever find if British people talk to you about like hip hop or something, they kind of, do you feel like, does that sound kind of weird?
That's a funny one to bring up. Because actually, well, that one's really layered because when British people talk to me about hip hop, I think I do have a sense, a very strong sense that that's like music from my world, from my culture. That's like kind of my music. But that in and of itself is a odd sort of sense because I'm a middle-class white guy, but I have a sense of like hip hop and I grew up listening to that, but it's just, there's sort of, that's sort of a unique insight into American culture and how black art interplays in white culture as I'm growing up and kids are growing up. But I do feel that sometimes, because I was touring when Kendrick Lamar's first record came out, and that was such a big talking point a lot of the time. And that was an interesting experience talking to British people and Europeans in general about that record and what it meant and how it struck me versus how it played out to them and things that were missed or things that perspectives that people had that were a little bit different than mine.
I get a sort of similar thing when anything that sort of crosses that sort of transatlantic thing, whether it's like comedy or music, I always found it fascinating that Americans could get into things like the British version of The Office the same extent as you could as a Brit, just because, which is probably said the same with like hip-hop going the other way, is that there's so many cultural references that go way over your head. You assume that the people aren't going to pick up on the nuances of it, but people completely get it, and it is universal.
Yeah, that's interesting. The journalist Simon Price made a really good point the other day about The Cure. he's listening to The Cure a lot, and The Cure are huge in Central America and South America, and it's like, what do they actually like about The Cure? I mean, The Cure are great, but is it the kind of grey Britishness of it that seems kind of almost like fantastical to them, you know? It's like, maybe yeah. there's an element of that when Americans get into British culture or comedy or music.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
lots to dig into there.
But so, yeah, Matthew, we've met before, obviously, but could you yes. give a little bit of background to the listeners about kind of, you're a musician yourself, but you've also kind of created an empire.
That's incorrect.
Do you
incorrect.
Want to kind of give an introduction to yeah. Space Bomb and that kind
Let
of
me
world?
Correct you. I started a record label in 2012 called Space Bomb Records, based out of Richmond, Virginia, that is started as a record label that's kind of based off a house band model like Motown or Stax, mm. and we have a strong group of musicians here. Then we invite artists to come in and we produce their records and then put them out. And the first thing we did was put out my first record, Beginner, which was more or less a business card for the label process.
Oh, shit, I've just realized that.
I've just
pun,
done the same thing. I know what you're going to say. 8 years later, yeah. I'm just hearing you actually say the title, yeah. and it Beginner. Was my favorite record of that year, and yeah. I've just realized
what's that,
it's a
like
pun.
7 years?
Wow.
2012, God. Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That English degree the 2012 really came out. Puts good use.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called Beginner, B-I-G space I-N-N-E-R for listeners. It's a pun that most people, I would say, didn't get, which I think makes it on the writer, not on the audience.
Like very much like the Beatles.
Yeah, right. Anyhow, that record came out and did good enough for us to kind of keep going. And so now I release music under my own name and also kind of work with the rest of the folks at Space Bomb to release other people's music and mm-hmm. produce some music as well. So it's kind
yeah.
of a short,
and,
very short version.
It's been a really good year for you. I mean, considering it's a Corona year, it's been a good year for Space Bomb, I guess. Cause...
pretty good year. It just depends on the metric you're using to measure things. But yeah.
great. That's such a good answer.
There are some things to be excited about. Yeah. You know, it's a journey. I mean, the music industry is a completely... it's like a totally fucked up industry. It's insane. It's completely insane. So some parts of that can be really fun and some parts of it are always frustrating. And, you know, it's always an adventure, you know, and especially now. I mean, now is like it was a Wild West before the spring and now it's just completely, totally
that's
opened
the thing,
up.
Like, COVID has almost kind of like, you know, pulled the curtain on problems with the music industry anyway. In some ways it's like musicians are saying, you know, well, obviously we can't tour now, but we couldn't really tour anyway.
yeah right. I mean there's just so many, you know, there's so many layers of what being a musician in the music industry is, and it all depends who's talking and what experiences they've had and what that, you know, just what that means for them. And then obviously what the COVID experience, kind of how that intersects with them. Cause some people it's kind of helpful to, I mean, not helpful, but like some people don't intersect with it in such a traumatic way, but then there's certain musicians that really do base their income off touring. And it's hard to think of a harder hit sector in any, in the whole sphere of things than the touring music industry. I mean, it's pretty much gone from 100 to 0. So, you know, so that can be really tough. But then some people are who don't rely on that, or whose like whole kind of artistic angle doesn't rely as much on touring and it intersects with social media or something like that. Like it's a great time for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I mean, it'll normalize
in some way.
Have you done
recording, like socially distanced recording this year then?
We did. I've started to do not. No, I haven't done any kind of like sort of Pro Tools sessions or like sending sessions around and stuff like that. That's really not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should do more of that. I just
now's the time.
It's just not. I just don't like that.
It's quite far away from the sort of space ball.
Yeah, so opposite of that.
Yeah.
I have started doing some sessions again, kind of like just rhythm section sessions, and then we're doing I'm doing a brass section outside actually on Monday, which is kind of fun.
So the house band idea, was that something that you sort of, did you always want to set yourself those parameters, or was it something that came out of recording beginner?
Oh, no. Beginner came out of the idea to do the label. I mean, the beginner, the story is basically I wanted to be a producer, so, but I didn't have any, the dream job for me was like a David Axelrod or somebody who just produced for a record label and kind of had the green light to do like wild shit. I mean, that was it. That was like, oh man, that would be the best thing ever. But that system didn't really exist in the music industry when I wanted to do that. So it was kind of like, that's what I want to do. Well, I need to set up a label that will be self-sustaining to hire me to do that.
Yeah.
And then to do that, we need to make a record that shows that we can do that. But then we didn't have any experience doing that actually. So I sort of self-volunteered to do that. And then I had to write songs to make the record. And then I had to sing the songs that I had written.
So basically, to quote William Blake, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just started putting that on the records. That was all kind of backwards. But I mean, the house band thing just came out of, I think, one, just being in a really special music community in Richmond and feeling that there was, with a little bit of organization, that it really was something magnetic and legitimately special. It wasn't just sort of a branding exercise. It was that, and I still, you know, I stand by this. It's like, I think when people come here and they are around the musicianship that's here, it's just pound for pound as good as any place in the world. And there's incredibly exceptional talent here that, you know, it's just kind of coming of age in that and feeling that and feeling like organizing that a little bit and focusing it would be something to give us, all of us musicians in that community, sort of an opportunity and just a good way to create an economy for ourselves to be professional musicians and do what we wanted to do. So the house band was just, I don't know, I was reading a lot about labels and it's kind of the music that I liked, just Southern Soul music and Motown and also read this incredible book called This Is Reggae Music, and just about the Jamaican music industry and just how, like, I don't know, how it's like really simple A to B in a lot of ways. It's just like, here's the band, here's the song, here's the singer, you make it, you put it out, people are attracted to it, you do it again. And that kind of just like system and the ability to kind of tweak that system and kind of continue to get better over a long period of time, instead of sort of trying to come at the music industry at an angle where you're kind of trying to sell kind of a personality or like a style or a caricature or something, like, was a lot more attractive to me. Yeah. Or, I mean, that's overstating it. I can't do it the other way. So it was like the only way that I felt like I could approach being a professional musician that was kind of also intersecting with like a creative, you know, was active in the actual industry, and I was making stuff, and I wasn't like a, you know, a professor or something like that. It was like, I wanted to make stuff and release it.
I think that's a reason. I mean, we're obviously going to talk about the Beatles, but I think that's a reason there's a nostalgia for the Beatles and for that time, was the idea that the music industry was a kind of industry. You know, there are people in white coats at Abbey Road, and, you know, I love the idea of, like, you know, the Brill Building or like Carole King turning up to work and your job is songwriting, you know, and the kind of the idea of the in-house band kind of plays into that kind of.
Yeah, definitely. And I think actually
it's a job, you know, and it's an industry, and, you know,
the Beatles really intersect with that whole thing. I mean, they were, you know, they're not a house band in that context, but I do think that they're an amazing example of, you know, the four of them on their own. You know, everyone has different opinions about this, but like when they start to intersect with George Martin and really using Abbey Road and kind of like maximizing the resources that are to their, or like are available to them, that's when that art starts to like be like almost intimidatingly good. It just goes from being like a band that's like, okay, great songwriters, they're magnetic, but there's a lot of that kicking around. And then you start to cross over, and 1 + 1, instead of equaling 2, it's like 1 + 1 = 10. And like that art, when they're kind of working at it in that way, is really, it's absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. I remember there was I listened to a really good interview with Giles Martin when the Sgt. Pepper remasters came out, and he was playing a bit of the intro from the, you know, Sgt. Pepper reprise. And he just made this point of just how like heavy they're playing. And he said, the phrase he used was, they really dug in, you know, and which is a great kind of musicianship sort of phrase. This idea that, you know, they hadn't played live much at that period, but I mean, they hadn't played live for a while at that period, but they were still like really going for it in the studio, you know, and that kind of that connection they had, you can really hear it in that record. The energy of a live band and with the studio to emphasize.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from they're not like a house band, but they have that same sort of drilled, like Hamburg thing where they're just playing 5 shows a night, and you know, they're so locked in when they get together in the room that even when it was the three of them in those sessions where they're very unenthusiastically jamming together for the anthology, there's still some kind of like weird magic going on there.
And for me, I mean, where I intersect with their art and where I feel really inspired by is the Beatles aren't just the four people. You know, it's like the music that Magical Mystery Tour, or Sgt. Pepper's, or the White Album. It's like, it's them playing, but it's the process is so much more than that. And the way George Martin is involved is ostensibly as a producer, but, you know, I mean, he's bringing stuff to the table that none of them could do. I mean, and even on tunes where they're not even playing, you know, or a couple of them are playing, it's not as if the Beatles meant that there were four guys playing on the track. That's not what the Beatles
fascinating
meant.
About the White Album for me is the idea of, you know, this was just one of them, this was two of them, this was Paul on drums, you know, this is George Martin doing this, you know, that's...
Yeah, and he's often the glue that sort of holds them all together, and like, his string writing in particular is absolutely second to none for someone who was just making comedy records. And you know, when you listen to the difference between the Phil Spector, you know, Phil Spector obviously was great at what Phil Spector did, but like he couldn't write a string octet.
No,
with that kind of nuance and balance, and it's perfect arrangement.
But that's one of the things as well. I often think, you know, there are so many elements that make a good album, and production is actually something that can be moving in and of itself. You know, I think when you mentioned dub and everything, dub is where you're taking production and giving it emotional resonance, you know, you know, that it's like literally, you know, you're going outside the frame and watching the kind of someone mixing and, you know, adding tons of reverb, delay or whatever. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that actually affects you on an emotional level, which is nothing to do with composition and nothing to do with like rhythm, you know, in the traditional sense, but it's actually the production itself. And I think that's, that's something I can hear in your records too.
Oh, well, yeah. Thank you. The only like Beatles stuff that I've like read, you know, like books that I've read or something like that, is like George Martin's book and Jeff Emmerich's book.
Right.
Which I think says a lot about how I hear that, you know, or like what I'm interested in when I hear that music. Cause I think so much of it is just this incredible intersection of talent. And then also the era of big studios, and they basically had free reign. Yeah. I mean, if you think about like the resources financially, even though it didn't break down like that for them necessarily, but just having something like Abbey Road at your disposal and the whole team at Abbey Road, like full time as much as you wanted it. I mean, that doesn't exist. Like I talk about this a lot. It's like nobody in the world right now, and probably for the past 40 years, has had the resources to do what they did. It doesn't exist. Like, and you know, and they stopped touring, which is obvious. People know that, but having toured a lot, it's like the weight of that decision for their album making is like maybe underrated a little bit, in terms of the, you know, like I think Sgt. Pepper's and Magical Mystery Tour came out like 8 months apart or 6 months apart or something. It's like insane. But at the same time, it's like they had all the resources in the world when it was like, hey, George, can you just like knock up this arrangement, you know? Like I would be just like, that would take me a year of scheming to figure out how to fund anything close to that. And they just had the ability to, you know, so it's just an incredible intersection of 20th century kind of momentum, you know, like from an arrangement and technology and the people that were in the room. And
I think Brian Epstein doesn't get enough sort of credit for that, because he was obviously incredibly reticent for them to stop touring, and he gets a lot of shit for all the terrible managerial decisions that he made. Yeah. But that agreement with EMI to get them unlimited studio time was probably one of the most important bits of paper ever signed.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of British music.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So did you grow up in Richmond, or you?
I grew up in Virginia Beach. Well, I grew up in a lot of places. Virginia Beach, the Philippines, Japan, and then ended up in
Richmond. I remember our mutual friend Ben saying, you know, that you grew up, when you were in the Philippines, you kind of missed out on a lot of things, like growing up, like you missed out. Like, is it true you like never saw Back to the Future until you were in your 20s or something?
Yeah, basically any of those movies like E.T., Back to the Future, Goonies, anything in the... I mean, I was there... I was born in 1982, but then moved over there when I was like 2 and a half, and then didn't come back till the early 90s. So,
did you miss any kind of musical cues at that kind of age, or were you picking them up from your parents?
No, I mean, my parents are a little older. I mean, I'm the youngest, and so my parents are kind of like the Elvis generation. Like they're not hippies. They're older than hippies, and But my parents, you know, I was talking to my wife the other day about they have pretty good taste. They would never call themselves like, you know, I don't know. They're not music nerds by any stretch of the imagination.
Hipsters.
But
we have hipsters.
No, not at all. That's funny. You know, there was stuff around the house, but there was nothing new. You know, like so anything like. Anything that came out in the 80s, like Michael Jackson or Guns N' Roses or anything like that, I didn't have any access to that. It was all like oldies, what we would call oldies over here. It was like oldies radio, so 50s, 60s, 70s stuff, some tapes like that around the house, kind of like greatest hits collection type stuff. So that's what I listened to until I went to middle school and realized that wasn't cool. And then I kind of briefly touched into, you know, more modern music. But in the Philippines, I lived on Penny Lane.
Right.
Oh, nice.
And I was little. So for the longest time, I thought that Penny Lane, it just never occurred to me that there was another Penny Lane.
Yeah. I love that kind of childhood thinking. Yeah.
I was like, that is so cool that the Beatles wrote this song about this street in the Philippines that I grew up on. That's so weird. But, you know, I was just... That sort of gave me an early life attachment to their music, which is totally based on, you know, it's not true, obviously, but that was
were you sort of imagining that street in the Philippines?
Yeah, well, it was like, man, it,
nurses selling poppies.
It's changed so much.
There's no barbershop or anything.
But that, you know, that was a long time ago. And anyway, that was always a fun. My first introduction to the Beatles was that those collections, like the blue one and the red one, where they're looking down. And that I had two tapes of that, I think, or I don't know. Somehow it was either tapes or CDs, but. And then whatever the early one is, I didn't like that one.
And, the red one.
Yeah. And I played the blue one, which I guess is the older one, like on loop. So that was kind of my first introduction to them. And I was pretty familiar with that music. And then kind of, as I got older, I started playing guitar and, you know, just sort of got into the history of rock and roll a little bit and then sort of dug into the music.
Is your title, if you have a job title, creative director?
Yeah.
So nice. What does that sort of entail in the studio?
Well, it all depends on the project, you know. I mean, broadly, it has to do with really broad themes of, you know, who are we dealing with, who our partners are. Like, you know, Space Bomb basically is a organization that partners with people that make music, and we can partner with them as a label or me as a producer or supplying musicians or as management or as a studio. And all of those partnerships, you know, have a certain tone, artistic tone to them. And so the broad thing is I just kind of look at and look after, like, are we still on pitch, you know, with all the partnerships when they add up, and like what kind of sound that they make, to keep that analogy going. And you know, just making sure it all kind of makes sense creatively. And that can be really broad. I mean, really, really broad. And then specifically in terms of like the record label and A&R and who we're signing and that kind of stuff, it's a little bit more maybe dialed in. You know, in the studio as a producer, it gets even more specific, you know. Like if I'm producing, it's what does the snare drum sound like? And
yeah.
What?
How's George Martin influenced you in that kind of more specific way, with kind of really drilling into, you know,
well,
compressors you like or something? I don't know.
I mean, there's really specific things. It's funny. I mean, on broad strokes, it's just orchestra plus rhythm section. Like that's something that was kicking around in the, you know, began sort of in the 50s and 60s, but that basic equation was sort of, you know, like we mentioned Phil Spector earlier, was, you know, some people parse that out in different ways. And some of it is kind of more based on sort of what we would call classical music models, where it's sort of vocals in front of, you know, put a broad orchestration, or on jazz band models, which is sort of a different sort of thing. And he just kind of, he did that as good as anyone's going to do it, you know, like, like how do you figure out how a rock and roll band plays, and, or people with that aesthetic and are kind of coming from like rock and roll theology, basically, you know, and what that means for the choices you're going to make harmonically and rhythmically. And then how do you deal with the art of orchestration and the art of composition as it pertains to kind of intersecting with someone who, you know, someone like Paul or John, who, you know, they want shit loud, and they want, you know, they want it to be rough in places and kind of odd. And I just feel like he did such an incredible job of marrying those two aesthetics that are that are kind of fundamentally coming from different places. So I would say broadly that's a big one. Specifically, there are certain ways I quote this all the time in his book. He talks about the better someone's voice is, the worse it sounds doubled, and the worse someone's voice is, the better it sounds doubled.
Yeah, well, that's very true for me.
me too. And so almost all the vocals on my records are doubled, and that's one of the reasons that I started doing that. Or when I was younger and I read that book, I was like, oh, I should try doubling my voice. And
well, that's it's so funny, isn't it? Double, like Elliot Smith as well, double tracking. You know, John Lennon is kind of, that's almost the Lennon sort of sound.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, it's like doubled and slapback, and like that's a little bit of the Matt White sound as well. I mean, it's like that worked for him, you know, and I think that works for a certain kind of vocalist.
With you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
There's kind of little things like that along the way, like,
yeah,
and just process too, like how you run sessions. And he really was a groundbreaker in terms of dealing with like modernity and like pushing forward, but not leaving kind of the art of orchestration and the art of the symphony kind of behind. And I think yeah. that, and I think his influence, mm-hmm. one thing that has been really important to Space Bomb and to me in particular is his influence on, this is sort of a weird left turn, but in Brazilian music and Tropicália music. And if you read interviews with those guys, like they'll just say like, we had sort of our own folk music and we had the Beatles and like, and that few years of like late '60s, early '70s, Brazilian Tropicália, which is some of the best music, if not the best music like made period in my point of view. It's like, they're kind of taking that thing that the Beatles did where it's just like, basically it's like weird shit and orchestra stuff and rock and roll. And they're kind of mixing it up in a different way. And yeah. I think that is, they're just not losing any of the art of orchestration, which is a really, yeah. really deep, important, exciting art. And George Martin was able to take that and not make it overly sentimental or kind of the things that we associate sort of like overproduced
yeah.
records with strings with, which, you know, with Phil Spector's work with the Beatles, people like, that's what they're basically taking issue with, is like that sort of tones doesn't quite hit in the same way as George Martin's
bizarre,
work,
isn't
does.
It? Like, I mean, you know, we've talked about this before, and it's obviously controversial at the time, but like, they just sound so Disney-ish, isn't it? But it's nothing you can put your finger on. Mm. Whereas if you take something like Eleanor Rigby, it's so frosty and kind of, there's something wintry about it, and you know, it's so evocative, the string sound.
It's the sort of stiff British restraint thing, maybe. I think, is, you know, I think with those strings, I can't imagine Phil Spector saying much more than, you know, more.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, and Phil Spector isn't a writer. I mean, he doesn't write that stuff. Like, he basically contracts that work out, literally. Yeah. He's not, whereas George Martin is in there writing. I mean, the horn arrangement on Obla Di Obla Da is, like, fucking genius.
Really?
It's unbelievable.
You're sort of, unbelievable. You're the, actually, because we did an in the forthcoming episode, we talked with one of my favorite musicians, Benoit Pialard, and he mentions the same thing. And we've talked a lot about how lots of people hate Obla Di Obla Da, but he's.
I know, I heard that. I heard that on an earlier podcast.
Yeah.
I heard that on an earlier podcast, and I have to take great issue with that. I think it's incredible.
I'm very much in the other camp.
you don't like it.
But my issues with it are not about the arrangements.
Yeah, the source, like the cultural appropriation issue, which is sort of...
it's just not.
you think it's cheesy? Do you think it's cheesy?
Yeah, it's cheesy. I wouldn't say it's like a cultural appropriation way, but it's in such a like white British reggae, middle class people doing reggae. I think in the 60s, calypso is very popular to like pastiche in like kind of light entertainment shows in the 1960s.
Yeah, it does smack of that
really kind of
Spike like, Milligan-y way. As in
but in a really sort of ignorant, stupid.
Right. I can see that.
I'm warming to it. And as I said before, I never skip it when I'm listening to the White Album. You know,
yeah, I think it's good. Great.
Don't like to boil down to favorites, but have you got one particular Beatles period or record that is personifies it all for you?
I mean, it's the two opposite ends of the spectrum. It's like the sort of Sgt. Pepper's Magical Mystery Tour thing, which is just maximalist, and I really like that. I feel like that's something that is kind of not cool right now to just be like, I'm going to spend all the money I possibly can spend on like most ridiculous shit. And like, and just, you know, like it's huge. It's absolutely huge. And it's conceptually big. It's, you know, the recording session, you know, everything about it is just maxed out. And it's like a, it's just a flex. It's like a Paul McCartney flex. And like that is really cool. I mean, and, and it's a, and it's great. And it's great. I love that. I love that he, that they just sort of went to the edge there. There's not much more you can do that they could have done, you know? I mean, they're good songs and they're great productions and it's great arrangements. It's just incredible group effort to get something like that made. I mean, the moving parts that go into getting a recording like that, and it's all on 4-track, which is just a miracle of recording. I mean, this, the, just the skill sets that are at work, they're just, it's not shaded, you know? So sometimes, like, when you listen to records, you're like, oh, that's tricky, and, like, you know, that's cool. They kind of snuck that in there. There's no sneaking about those two records. It's just like, here's how good we are. just like, look at it again and again and again and again in neon lights. And, like, that's, I like that. And then I like the White Album a lot. I think it's too long. And I like, and it's great because of that. And it's really aggressive and weird. It's odd. Sort of a personal story about the White Album is when I was in college, there was this guy named Steven Bernstein, who's a trumpet player. Was kind of based in New York and was sort of involved with kind of like John Zorn world, if you're familiar with that. Like New York downtown, Mark Ribot, all those guys, and was kind of friends with Lou Reed and like was his, Lou Reed's musical director. Just kind of like in, basically he was like the trumpet player and arranger who did like all the coolest shit in New York and would played in Levon Helm's band for a long time. And just, he like had all the gigs that you would dream of as a horn player and arranger. And so I just, definitely the most influential musical event in my life is I emailed his record label actually. And then, was like, hey, is there any way to get in touch with this guy? And they just sent me a cell phone number. And I cold called this guy and was like, hey, my name's Matt. I was probably like 21 years old. And I was like, hey, I'd love to just basically take a lesson, was how I phrased it. I was just, I want to take a lesson from you about arranging, because that was kind of like my thing at the time. And and he called me back and was super cool. I mean, just way, way, way too cool. And I lied and told him that I was going to be up in New York for a few months and that I could come by his house anytime. And he just named the time and I just took off of school. You know, it's like I took off a few days and just drove up to New York. And for a few years, I would go up there a few times a year and just kind of sit with him in his back room and just listen to records and listen to, and he had, you know, it's like, he just had, cause as a trumpet player and arranger, so he get hired for a few different things, you know, you get hired as a trumpet player and he had worked with like Aretha Franklin and Dr. John and Alan Toussaint and like all these, like basically everybody that you could imagine working with that you would want to work with. And then as an arranger, he had worked on a lot of really cool things too. And worked with Hal Wilner actually, who just recently passed because coronavirus, and they were like best buds. But anyway, but all that to say, a lot to unpack from that, but all that to say is the first time I was there, he's like a jazz guy, you know, and I was in jazz school, so I was you know, so it was like I was kind of interested in the Gil Evans of the world and like just kind of when jazz sort of just really blatantly intersected with you know, rock and roll or something, just things, it was kind of more worn on its sleeve or productions that were more like that. And I remember when we were talking about arranging, the one of the first things he brought up was like, how familiar are you with the White Album? And I was, at that time I was like, you know, the last time I listened to the White Album probably was kind of when I was like a hippie in high school and was sort of like quote unquote past that, like in my jazz asshole head, you know, and you know, he was just kind of like, well, how familiar are you with this record? And I was like, I don't know, I've heard this. I know this music, you know, or whatever. And he was like, you need to live with this record over and over and over again. This is unbelievable arrangement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's not talking about George Martin's work or like the, he's talking about the band playing, he's talking about the choices that they're making as a creative group, not just the choices that George Martin's making as an arranger, and like, and how arrangement and production kind of like, you know, as we move on in the 20th century, they kind of like morph into one thing a little bit. And, and the White Album is such a good example of musicality and high level, just really in-depth thinking about how you make a record and the choices you make without it wearing itself on its sleeve, like they do on Sgt. Pepper's, which is maybe a little bit like gross at times, you know, because it's like, it's so filled up, you know, in that way. And that was a real like lesson, you know, in terms of how to listen to music, and that's been really influential to me as a decision maker, and, you know, kind of changed my relationship with that record a little bit. It's just interesting to hear a guy like that, out of all the records that he could have pulled out,
you know,
all the music that he's familiar with, just be like, the White Album, this is some heavy shit for an arranger, you know, that's not really like where you would go normally. And that was really cool. One last story. We went into, when I was first touring beginner, one morning we kind of woke up and they were like, do you want to go to Abbey Road? And I was like, hell yeah. Of course. We'll want to go. And they do a tour. They take you on, you know, you just go and they sort of show you around the spot. Have either of you guys been to Abbey Road?
No, no.
Well, it's, you know, it's funny because it's like a functioning recording studio, you know, they're trying to keep alive in the days of home recording. But so I think they try to bring bands there because they're actually trying to drum up business, which is ironic or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It sort of struck me as like, wow, really? Abbey? Not that they don't really say that out loud, but I think, you know, that's kind of part of it. And anyway, the point is we went to the Beatles room, is like, it looks exactly the same. Exactly the same. They take you to that Studio 3 and you walk in, and it was like, to be honest, I'm not super nostalgic for music stuff or kind of like a collector or like, you know, like just I don't go in for that a lot. But walking into that room, it was just got chills. Like you walk in, it's just like, oh my God, it's like all here. And it looks exactly just like all those pictures. And then Trey, it's like my best Instagram video ever, is the, you know, the guy's there and he's just sort of like throwing off stuff like, oh yeah, this is the mic that they recorded the lead vocals for this on. And it's just like, it's just ridiculous, the stuff that's still there. And then he's like, yeah, this is the Lady Madonna piano. And I was like, what? You know, it's just so weird that it's still there and it's still fine. And then just, so Trey, like, oh, and I was like, can we play it? And my buddy Trey is playing piano in the band. It was like, he just opened up the lid and starts playing Lady Madonna.
Whoa.
And that's, it was crazy. Like the odd, but the crazy thing, I mean, it sounds, it's so obvious, but it sounded exactly like Lady Madonna. Oh, like that's just the sound of this piano. This piano sounds like. And like, that was such a, I don't really know what that taught or shows, but it was just this really odd moment that all he did was just like play the piano and that was it. I mean, it was exactly what that riff sounded like. And it was really cool. It was really cool. It was a really weird moment. Sort of surreal.
I'm so glad all those instruments are still there and they're not precious about them. And, you know, they're still used on those recordings. If some millionaire bought that and it just sat and went out of tune in some dining room somewhere.
There's this guy called Lester, the microphone tester, that you should get on the show, actually, if he is still around. He's an elderly man who has been there for, I mean, like 70 years or something. I mean, like a long, long time. Whoa. And all he does is just keep up the microphones.
So cool.
And he just, it's like, you go, and we went into his office, and it's just like this little office, and he just has just like these pull out trays, and it's just like $1 million worth of microphones, you know, in each tray. Yeah. He just like pulls it out, and it's just like, it's just unbelievable the gear that's still there. And then he just had all this, knew everything about every one of them. And he was so charming and such a great host. And
wow,
just, I mean, had every story in the book, you know, about his experience there. But he had just been, you know, he worked at Abbey Road his whole entire life and just fixed microphones. And then he showed us the first stereo microphone that had ever been made, and it was like it's like a comedy, like what's in that building, that, you know. And he said this is the best, you know, this is the best microphone selection in the world, like, you know, no one, it's not really repeatable, you know. And I think that's what's so interesting about the whole thing. It's just like, this is the whole ecosystem there, it's just an unrepeatable event that you know, to some extent, it's still there and still available, which is kind of cool. Anyway, that was a fun experience.
I was going to say, this isn't to do with the Beatles, by the way. But do you remember, because I'd met you a few times. I think the first time I met you was about when The Beginner came out, which obviously the pun is so obvious now I say it. But I saw you in London. I saw you a few times on that tour, like through our friend Ben and everything. And then I was playing with a band I was rehearsing in Utrecht, and I realized you were playing across town in the Tivoli. Yeah. Do you remember this? I was with the band I was playing with, and I was like, we were going for dinner, and I thought, oh, I'll just pop over the road and just say hi to Matt and the band and everything. And the Tivoli was like miles away, and then my phone died. And then, so I like got to the venue, and it was like really early. It was like 7. And there's a security guard there saying, oh, hey, I just want to like, say hi to them because I know them. And then I realized I sounded mad, and like he didn't let me in. So he said, we'll just but get a ticket like everyone else. I was like, yeah, I will. Like, you know, I'm, you know. So I got a ticket, and it was like, you were on at like 10. So it was like, so what do you do when you're at a gig on your own? Just
get pissed.
I got really drunk, and so like basically the only time I had to queue to buy a t-shirt at the end to say hi. It was like basically wanted to say hi because I'm in town. Like I had 10 pints and I had to buy a t-shirt.
That's funny. That's good context.
It was great. Great times though.
Yeah. That's fun. That's a good story.
But, you know, if COVID wasn't happening, I guess, what are your plans musically? Are you going to release another album of your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I had a record on the books for just right smack in the middle of COVID time. So that got pushed. I mean, you know, I'm thankful for that, actually. It's better that it's pushed than it came out. So, and then there's another kind of collaborative record that I made so I think, you know, I'm about to kick off it's been a while since I've released some music, and I think the next year will be, I have a lot of stuff that's kind of, you know, been recorded. So kind of just start getting that out there, and hopefully things will open up a little bit and I'll get to travel. But if not, you know, there's new music coming. I'm really excited about it, and, you know, I like it at least. So maybe other people
look forward to hearing it.
So that was the brilliant Matthew E. White. Fantastic guest. Thrilled to hear that there is a record coming out soon. If you haven't heard his solo albums, they're really worth checking out, especially for just the way they sound. I mean, Space Bomb's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
They're such sonically interesting records. They're sort of retro, but it's very modern at the same time. I absolutely love them. I really love his work on Natalie Press's album. Didn't even get a chance to talk about that. Didn't get a chance to talk to him about Randy Newman as well, which I know he's a huge fan and really wanted to bring that up. So, you know, there was so much stuff in there that you know, we could have talked to him for hours. It was fantastic.
Yeah, the Space Bomb records are brilliant. You can hear elements of soul and classic rock and the influence of hip-hop, which we kind of briefly touched on as well. And yeah, there were some brilliant stories about touring and visiting Abbey Road as well. So it was highly enjoyable.
Yeah, great stuff. Mm. And we'll be back next week with another fantastic guest. We're going to be talking to comedian Gabby Best, who is a fantastic comedian and a big Yoko Ono fan, I think.
Nice.
So that, we should get some brilliant stories out of that. Really looking forward to that one. You can keep your personal Beatles stories coming in. Don't forget to contact us, personalbeatles.com/contact. And yeah, I mean, we won't hammer home the donation thing, but you know, we would really love it if you'd donate to the show and help us cover the costs for the last few remaining episodes. We've got some amazing guests coming up. And if you have enjoyed the show, you can go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and leave a nice review. We love reading them. We'll read out some of the best ones. And yeah, they're really appreciated and really help other people find the podcast. So thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week with Gabby Best.
See ya.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.